Britain remains a military power out of all proportion to its economic standing. Its soldiers still fight in corners of the world far removed from this tiny island off the northwest coast of Europe. Hundreds have died in Afghanistan and Iraq in the last decade. I'm Joe Glenton. I was Lance Corporal Glenton of 13 Air Assault Regiment until I was jailed for refusing to fight in Afghanistan. And that's why it's important for me to find out why young men volunteer to risk their lives in conflicts which the majority of their fellow citizens regard as unjust and illegal. But the same question is important for every parent who has a son or daughter of recruitment age, and for every taxpayer who cares how the military spend their money, and for every citizen who cares about the political health their country. So join me for The Soldier Myth and The War on Terror, a four-part series that talks to frontline soldiers about recruitment, training, fighting, and coming home. The tempo of military operations today means that if you join the British Army, it's only a matter of time before the call comes through to prepare for war. Even though he was only halfway through pre-tour training, Glenn jumped at the chance to deploy early.
My staff sergeant came over, and my sergeant came over to the pet ops and said, right, need two volunteers to go out in a week's time. And no one said anything except for me and another chap, Robbo. And we volunteered ourselves to go out there. And they just said, get ready, you're going to Afghanistan to an operation, you know. That was it, you know. That was the realisation that I was going to another country to help fight a war.
Why did you volunteer?
Because I looked around me and no one volunteered. And someone was going to get picked, or dicked as they called it, for choosing someone. And I thought, well, the sooner I get out there, the better, because I'm going to go out there. I thought, well, I might as well go out there a month earlier and get it, you know, get it squared away, get it sorted, go out there and start the job that I was entrusted to do, you know.
Matt Horn had already been through months of torturous infantry training when he was told he was going to Iraq.
For myself, being told that I was deploying to war wasn't necessarily a big problem to me. I never really felt any different.
Were you scared?
No. I didn't feel any different. If anything with fear, I would probably say I was probably more scared for what would happen if something happened to me in respect to what would happen to my family.
For Craig Rutherford, the reality of what he would face only hit home as his plane descended into Iraq.
That's when it really kicked in. Because you're in the Hercules, next minute lights out and you just hurt them, flying down, that's it, you're straight in. The alarms straight away, sirens kicking off, everything like that, boom, bang, everything like that. So we're straight in, straight down, you're legging it straight in, you're on your belt buckle.
When soldiers are killed in Afghanistan or Iraq, statements are released by the commanding officer praising the individual.
The thought of man killing man ought to fill us with grave sadness.
To me, the familiar tone of these statements always seemed odd, because the commanding officers of regiments have relatively little contact with low-ranking soldiers. I read out the statement to Joan.
Kevin was on the verge of leaving the army earlier this year, but the inclination to be in the thick of the action proved too tempting, and he caught the last transport to Afghanistan with his mates.
Well, that wasn't a situation that I understood. The army are very, very good, as you'll know, Joe, it's really good. They bring people together, they support each other. It'd be great if other organisations such as schools could do the same, which is the only thing I can ever see nice about the military. But no, it was his friends nothing to do with, oh, let's go out there and kill people. I mean, that got me so angry when he said he would have been in the thick of the action. So obviously that was after Kevin was dead. But no, that wasn't the situation. He wanted to be with his friends.
While only the soldiers go to war, those left behind cannot escape the impact of the deployment. Matt's main concerns weren't going to war.
Mum's never been one for, you know, getting all emotional and upset about things, but I don't really know what they felt about it, but my mum's always upheld that thought that I'm gonna do it anyway. I'm gonna do what I think is right. So she's never sort of stepped in the way and said no.
Craig deployed to Iraq just as his brother came back.
How did your family react when they found out you were going?
Obviously, weren't too happy about it, like, but Dad, I'd say he was proud, obviously. Mum, not so proud, like,
worried.
But worried, because of, like, finding out, like, another, like, sort of straight after each other, it's, like, not really a good thing.
Glenn only had a matter of days to tell his family he was going to war. Their fear was apparent and well-founded.
I don't think you really know if it's like what the television showed, which is bombs all the time, things being blown up, people losing limbs and all that. So I didn't know if that's really what it was like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I was also quite nervous because stupidly volunteering myself, I left myself hardly any time to say goodbye to my friends and family, let alone my girlfriend, my wife.
Craig deployed to Iraq at the height of the insurgency. At that time, the country was disintegrating as a result of the occupation.
Going into that and knowing that at the time, what were your biggest fears?
Being killed, really, you know, just IEDs. There's always, like, it's like a game of bingo, really, you know, like, so the rockets flying in, it's just always, like, whether you're hit, you know what I mean? It's like, you could just be lying there, sleep 1 second, that's it.
Craig and Matt both spent the first days of their tour in Kuwait, acclimatising and preparing to be sent to Iraq.
Getting to Kuwait, I didn't even think it was, didn't sink in. Just like, you get there, everyone's just standing around, like, getting sectioned off to where you're getting sent to or wherever they are.
Temperatures were getting in, you know, up to 55 degrees. And if you're wearing all that body armour and all that kit, 55 degrees, and then if you're in the back of a vehicle, bear in mind, these vehicles don't have air conditioning. They meant to, but they're often broke.
On arrival, the Iraqis beyond the perimeters of Craig's base had prepared something of a welcoming party.
It was full on. The new, I think the known, like, that were, like, you know, when the new people come in and things like that, were right, I think the known, like, because there was the alarms, everything was just going wild.
Craig Rutherford was a driver in the logistics corps. He was charged with moving men, ammunition and equipment along the deadly IED-ridden roads of Iraq to supply other units. I asked him if he had a sense of the overall operation.
I went to Afghanistan, I didn't know what the bloody hell I was doing. No, we were just told you're going, that's it. You know what I mean? But when you were out there, did you feel like you were kind of helping Iraqis? I mean, you know, did you understand what you were doing in that sense?
In a way, I don't know. I've done, like, night ops, things like that. It was just, like, some drop-offs, pick-ups, you know, travelling to Safwan Hill, Safwan border, come back, stuff like that. Then I would be, like, basically, I'd just be put on guard. I got put on guard for quite a while at the Cobb Gate.
So do soldiers really understand what's going on? Given that Matt was involved in communications and intelligence activity, I thought he might have had a better idea than me or Craig.
The tasks assigned to us were sketchy at best.
One of my roles, or my main role when I served in Iraq, was to carry out these night raids, to use explosives to get in people's houses, you know, to search the house for any weapons and money, computers, and then to divide the family up, males in one room, females in the other, and then any males that were deemed as sort of military age, sort of 15, 16, up to about 60, would be carted off for interrogation.
Halfway through an operational tour, soldiers are sent home for 2 weeks of rest and recuperation.
Rest and recuperation, which is the 2-week break you get in tour, is a weird is a weird thing, because when I came back, I drank a lot.
Yeah.
I remember Magnus had just come out, so I drank a lot of that. But I wanted to go back because that was my world at that time. All my mates were there, and it felt like it was another 2 weeks I'd have to spend there. I felt I wanted to get back to the people who understood what I was feeling at the time and who I had shared experience with. Was it like that for you?
I was looking forward to the break, because since I'd been out there, I had probably about 2 days off, because I had about 4 or 5 months. No, it wouldn't be even that. Sorry, it'd be about 2.5 or 3 months out there and without a break. And when I got back, I drank a lot as well, and was like a minor celebrity to my friends, which is quite enjoyable. But after the first week, yeah, I wanted to go back, I suppose. I can agree with you that.
The experiences of war are powerful. Many soldiers join the army to see the world, and they experience things which they would never see otherwise. Every soldier has a war story to tell. In fact, the exchange of these experiences is central to military culture.
We were specifically told not to let the Afghan National Army, ANA, speed into camp, because they had a tendency to do that. And if they do it, you'd stop them and try and use it to explain to them they can't do that, because they could be anyone, couldn't they? Right? And that specific time, I was on the rifle and the other guy had to slow him down because they were speeding him. Slowing right down, and they were confused, didn't understand why, but we weren't warned that they came in because they were contacted. And as they drove past in their pickup trucks, there was a lot of soldiers with blood everywhere, basically. Mumbling, screaming, crying, all in the back of their trucks, not knowing where they were, basically, and they were off to the med centre.
When Matt was in Iraq, operating in the signals and intelligence cell of his regiment, he witnessed numerous drone operations. The use of drones is highly controversial and is one of the main grievances of people in occupied Iraq and Afghanistan.
In the ops room, or even on the vehicles that we go out on the ground, we always had a screen with the infrared imagery from whatever was in the sky, whether it be a Predator, other various types of drones, or Apaches. And even from my time in front of those screens, I've probably seen in excess at least 400 people killed. I remember one incident quite vigorously, that there was a white truck northwest of the cop that fired. I was outside having a cigarette at the time, and all of a sudden I heard this like bang. Eventually the drones found this truck, the northwest of the cop, that had fired an RPG into where the tanks were at the top. And now I was driving down the east side of the cop, and drone locked on, following it down, just following where it's going. And eventually it went to a mosque type building. And at first they didn't fire on it, but eventually our chain of command given was the permission to fire, and so they did. Bear in mind, this is a mosque. They hit it, and next thing, all these people come running out. So you're talking 10 times the amount of people killed to capture one person that fired. Yeah, there were two drivers or two people with them, but only one person fired, and they didn't even hit anyone. So is that appropriate force? That's the kind of indiscriminate killing that, I mean, Julian Assange publishing that video proves exactly what I've just said, that willingness to just open fire.
While he was working in a forward operating base or FOB, and despite not being an infantry soldier, Glenn was drafted into a patrol of paratroopers due to lack of personnel. On the way back from...
Next thing you heard is a shooting sound, like a zipping sound like you hear on the movies. And we came under contact from, I suppose, the Taliban. So we ran straight into the first irrigation trench that we could come to. And at that point, yeah, in that trench with mortars, not mortars, RPGs going off and rounds hitting the soil was probably the most terrifying thing I've ever had in my entire life, to be honest. And the only way to get out of it was to run through that field every so often, going into those trenches, and then trying to climb out again to get to another one. But as we were having to do that, we were having to try and give cover and fire to the guys getting out so they can get out. And then when they get out, hoid us up. And at that point, you could see, I think they're the Taliban, but they were your typical dressed, you know, guys with AK-47s firing at us. And there was like a mud, what's it called, a mud wall further afield from where they were firing from. And they were trying to, you could see them bobbing their heads up, trying to get over. So we fired into that position. And like, I can remember looking down my SUSAT, which is the sights. So as you zoom in a little bit, doesn't it? And I saw a guy trying to get over. And I shot him. And he fell down, and that was it. For about 3 hours, we were clumbing from each of the trenches trying to get back to the SNATS Land Rovers. And we eventually did, with no casualties.
One of Ben's main roles was breaking into houses and kidnapping Iraqi civilians for interrogation. House raids are the other major grievance among Iraqis and Afghans. In Afghanistan, there are around 40 a night, and when soldiers come calling, they don't tend to knock.
When you use explosives to get into someone's house, you leave a big gaping hole either in the doorway or the wall. So you've destroyed the secure nature of that building. Which in Iraq at the time, a very dangerous city, Baghdad, a very dangerous city, lots of, not just insurgents, but criminal gangs operating in the city. So you've left that family now open to attack. What effect you would have had on the younger people in that house, you know, traumatic effect of waking up in the middle of the night to explosions and smoke and dust, you know, and having a lot of big armed men in the house, you know, what sort of traumatic effect that would have long term on these people. Taking away the male from that house, who provide the security, provide the food, the money that's coming in. The effect on the children of seeing their sort of hero, the hero figure within the house, dragged out of the house. You know, a lot of these people, piss themselves. You know, for a family to see that, to see the hero of the house in that state and to see them cuffed and hooded, and it must have been terrible. And it had a big impact on me, and I think it impacted on other people. You know, a lot of the arguments that we had in Iraq, within my unit anyway, were about issues arising from this. Also, when you do this day after day after day, I can honestly say that it's nothing to do with being pumped up. You know, this just becomes a sort of long drag of endless jobs. Some nights we'd go through 3 or 4 different addresses.
So did this method help stem the insurgency and improve things for the Iraqi population?
I firmly believed at the time, and still believe, that most of the people we picked up had nothing to do with an insurgency. Were guilty of no crime, and yet we took them away. If they were lucky, they would be released after a few days, and then they've got to answer the questions of the community. Why have you been released? What have you told them? Oh, you've sold out your mates, have you? You've sold out your family, you've sold out the guy down the street. Why have you been released? You're working for them now. If you're a bit more unlucky, you might end up in somewhere like Abu Ghraib and spend months there without charge, you know, in these terrible conditions. And if you were really unlucky, you'd end up in one of the secret prisons, one of the secret detention centres where you would have been tortured.
For Ben, one of the main issues was the quality of the intelligence they were receiving.
There was no real way of improving the intelligence. If you buy intelligence, people will tell you stuff to get the money. You know, high unemployment, someone's offering money for information, you're going to keep going back and give them as much information as you want. I think we probably got involved in local feuds. I think we probably got involved in family feuds, you know, local religious feuds, all sorts of things where we were probably inadvertently, you know, picking up the rival of another gang, or picking up the, you know, someone who's had a grievance against someone else down the road.
These methods helped to decrease the already limited legitimacy of the occupiers, and, among other factors, caused the insurgencies to gain strength.
More and more of the local population decide they're not going to put up with this, and then they take up arms against them, and then they become the new enemy. So it becomes a completely vicious cycle. And actually, the very recent number of sectarian killings in Iraq that have been going on in recent months, one of the things that now is being said is that Al-Qaeda has a tremendous stronghold in Iraq. And the only conclusion you can draw is that this war on terror, which started 11 years ago to root out Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan, has succeeded in rooting it out from Afghanistan, to send it to Pakistan, to Iraq, to Yemen, to Somalia, and who knows where else. That is actually what is going on here.
The effects of official training and indoctrination can be among the first casualties of the war. For some soldiers, they begin to see the enemy are not an alien or irrational enemy, but people like themselves.
But you do think maybe that person had a family of his own. Maybe he was my age and his mother and father wouldn't have a son to go home. You know, you do think of those things.
I suppose the question you ask yourself is, how would I feel? You know, how would I feel if this was happening to my family or people that I knew? You know, how would I even feel if this was just happening to people of the same ethnic and cultural background as myself? You know, like, so, for example, we never carried out these sorts of raids in operations in Yugoslavia. In modern time, so sort of post-1990, we never carried out these raids in Northern Ireland. You know, how would I feel about that? And for me personally, I found these raids disturbing. I found what we were doing disturbing. And I did think, you know, how would I feel if this was my family? How would I feel if these were people that I actually knew? But I was disturbed enough by the fact that that I was doing this and was part of doing this to another human. It didn't really, to me, obviously I thought about how, you know, what if this was my family, but it was enough that these were just scared children, this was scared women, scared men.
These stories seem to hint at a major and often hidden paradox. It seems to be the case that despite months or years of training and preparing to fight and to kill, the contradictory nature of the war on terror is visible to the soldiers. These are not, as the cliche goes, robots or mindless killers. They are people, often people with recognisably human intentions. I asked Dr. Neil Faulkner to put this in a historical context.
I think the great majority of serving soldiers are decent guys, and they have got all of those feelings of, you know, compassion, of concern for others, of wanting to do good that all of us have. And I think what happens in a conflict like the conflict raging in Afghanistan at the moment is that that is inevitably in contradiction with the role that they're actually being required to play. And what happens in some cases is they work out that it's actually a contradiction, that they're fighting a war against a population which is understandably resisting because they're experiencing foreign occupation. And those contradictions then cause a major crisis for the individual soldier trying to deal with the situation. Now, there are others that try to suppress the contradiction, and I think there are some that are probably brutalised by it, because one way in which you can deal with it is you suppress it completely and you become brutalised by the whole experience, in which case you become a kind of expression, really, of the imperialist character of the war. What's interesting, I think, for those of us who are opposed to imperialist war and who are trying to stop them happening, is that contradiction between the good intentions of the great majority of ordinary people caught up in this situation, and whatever side they're on, the contradiction between that and the reality of our rulers setting us up to fight one another in their interest but not in our interest. That contradiction is very, very important in the possibilities of building anti-war resistance.